Big Brother is not the problem, and privacy is not the solution. Big Brother was a character invented by George Orwell, a very prescient novelist of 1984, who gave us the leading metaphors that have been used not only in the popular press and media since the Second World War, but also within political science, sociology, policy fields, privacy, data protection departments, all those kinds of things all refer to Big Brother as a leading metaphor. Let me suggest that what has happened in the intervening years between 1984, which was a warning about bureaucratic government and the capacity of a top-down pyramid of control to radically affect the lives of all who were at the bottom of the pyramid. What's happened since then is, in particular, in the 1960s and 1970s, departments were computerized, and what that has led to eventually, with the remote networking of computers between different agencies and departments, is a far more networked kind of surveillance. 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 It's now nodes within a system that shifts and undulates and moves all the time. It's flows of data that have become crucially important, rather than the omnipresent telescreen from which Big Brother can watch all those hapless citizens of Oceania. However, it's a mistake to think that we have somehow moved from that Big Brother situation to an entirely different situation. Although we live in what now might be called a surveillance assemblage, a collection of loosely knit surveillance networks that are everything from the consumer networks through to policing and intelligence networks and many others in between, that although we do live in that kind of situation, the capacity of centralized powers to use the integration capacities of those network systems still means that we have to be very vigilant about surveillance systems in general. We saw that particularly after September the 11th. You'll remember the pictures of Mohammed Atta and his associates that appeared on TV screens and in newspapers the world over. Those images of these people who were collecting groceries from convenience stores, gas from the gas station, going into motels. We saw their records of their telephone calls, their email use, their obtaining airline tickets online, and so on. So what was happening there was that after the event, investigations were able to draw upon that loose-knit, flowing surveillance assemblage, and to bring together discrete bits of data, images, transaction details, and so on, to be used in the investigative process. All those claims that are made by the high technology companies following September the 11th, that their new system, whatever it is, FACEIT or many others have been offered, will actually prevent terrorism, is a claim that should be taken with a pinch of salt. There are great problems in moving from that investigation of events that have already occurred through to the notion that you can actually anticipate, preempt, and prevent some undesired event from occurring.
And now pre-crime can work for you.
We want to make absolutely certain that every American can bank on the utter infallibility of this system. And to ensure that what keeps us safe will also keep us free, 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 free.
There are certain junctures when we have to be especially vigilant about surveillance systems because they, for some reason, have shifted more towards the control than the care motif. And I would argue that after September the 11th is precisely one of those junctures when surveillance is being intensified, and because of the kind of surveillance that is being perpetrated, it is likely to lend itself much more to control than to care, despite the fact, of course, that it is being set up after September the 11th precisely with the leading argument that our security will be guaranteed. Today's surveillance has to do with categorization, classification, using searchable databases that are usually remotely accessible. And it's because we can build up lists of groups of people, clusters of people, who are categorized in particular ways, such that that categorization process continues automatically. Some algorithm is used in order to secure the coding of that categorical group. And that's the way that surveillance works. We are located within a particular group. How you have behaved as a consumer does have long-term implications for your life chances in the area where you live and work. So there are at least reliable studies that are being made about how those kinds of consumer surveillance do have an effect on people's life chances and choices. And it's at that level, based on good evidence, that we need to begin the what I think of as the ethical scrutiny and the political participation in the process. Frequently, privacy is seen as an antidote to surveillance. It's the thing that you try to protect from surveillance. Let me suggest to you that privacy actually causes surveillance. Privacy actually causes surveillance. In the 20th century, lives became far more privatized, far more individualized than they had been in previous centuries. It became increasingly desirable to live relatively anonymous and autonomous lives, largely in urban areas. It was a major shift of the 20th century. Within that situation, privacy, the search for privacy, the quest for privacy, produced a need for some kind of means of knowing that you can trust the person that you're dealing with. And so what happened during the 20th century was a proliferation of all manner of little, what we might call, tokens of trust. So it is that all of you carry with you some little tokens, usually embossed in or embedded in plastic, including perhaps magnetic strips, perhaps even chips, that are intended to show that you are eligible to be here, that you have a right to drive this vehicle, that you can claim this benefit, that you have money that can be withdrawn from an account, and so on and so forth. We all engage in a whole web of relationships with others and with agencies that we have no personal knowledge of, and they have no personal knowledge of us. And so to maintain some sense of our trustworthiness and that we are eligible, valid, and so on and so forth, we use these tokens of trust. But each of those tokens of trust is also a way of locating ourselves within a network, within a web of surveillance. So, as I understand it, surveillance is an ambiguous process. It's one that we engage in and we comply with just because we get all kinds of benefits from it. We have convenience, safety, security, comfort, efficiency, all those kinds of things that are highly prized by many are the reasons why we go along with surveillance systems most of the time. So surveillance has that dual aspect to it. It always has that ambiguity. On the one hand, there are ways in which we have to comply. There are ways in which there is control involved, proscription of our behaviors. On the other hand, there is some protection for us, some care, some guarantee for rights that we may have. So surveillance systems are bound up with a highly ambiguous set of relationships. After September the 11th, what we have seen is a huge thrust of activity to introduce new technological modes of combating what is called terrorism. But it's very much a case of technology against terrorism, which in the first place, I think, should raise some questions for us. Why technology against terrorism? Simply because during the 20th century, a rapidly increasing implicit faith in the power of technology to solve human problems became evident. The kinds of technologies that have been thrown at terrorism, supposedly, include biometrics in general as modes of identification and pre-identification, along with other sorts of systems, smart card identifiers for nation states. Several of these have had their systems brought forward or have started to talk about the possibilities of national systems of identification using smart cards and usually with some kind of embedded biometric in them. Communications interception, again, continuing the kinds of trends that were perfectly evident before September the 11th and so on. But it's a classic way of coping with attacks and threats of violence to introduce some new technology.
Yeah. We've arrested to arrest individuals. We can't detain individuals. We've arrested, and that's why we've arrested individuals. I don't have any reason to believe we're involved. We'll do everything we can to arrest reason.
So Big Brother isn't exactly the issue any longer. We're not looking at a situation where there are specific people being targeted for specific purposes and singled out for attention. Of course, that happens. But surveillance now affects all of us in the routines of everyday life. It is unavoidable, whether we're on the street, at work, in a cab, on a plane, in an airport, in a school, wherever we are, there are means of keeping tabs on us that have been developed, especially since the 1970s and 80s. So many privacy policies and laws around the world are based upon placing the responsibility back on the individual person. It is my responsibility or your responsibility, A, to discover that our privacy has been violated, and then to know what are the recourses, what we can apply and to whom we can find some, from whom we can find some support to overcome that situation. My argument would be to turn the thing around altogether and to introduce much stronger arguments that the onus should be on those who process personal data to show that they are accountable and transparent. That is the way around that it ought to be. Given the amount of power that is appropriated by those who are in charge of social sorting, it seems to me that the onus should be on them to be accountable. So whether it's closed-circuit television systems, smart cards as identifiers, irises and retinas as biometrics, whatever it is, it seems to me we need to turn the question around, ask questions of accountability first, before we ask questions about my personal privacy and how I go about defending it.
Think for yourself, and question authority.